This week's episode of the FitCast is brought to you by TurbulenceTraining.com. Boost muscle growth and blowtorch body fat at TurbulenceTraining.com. Also by BlackStarLabs.com. You can save 10% on every order when you use the code FIT10 at checkout. That's FIT10. Throw that in the comments section at checkout to save 10%. And by RobertsonTrainingSystems.com, where you can pick up the new 2008 Indianapolis Seminar DVD set with Bill Hartman and Mike Robertson. All right, folks, here it is, episode 100, the episode you've all been waiting for. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and I'm by myself this time because things are a little hectic right now. I'm actually flying back home to Boston in the next 2 days, so packing up and cleaning things up around here in Santa Monica is my main priority, but we did wrap up two great interviews for you. The first one you're going to hear is with Dr. John Berardi, and the second one is with Tom Venuto of BurnTheFat.com. So we have two fantastic interviews lined up for you. And you know what? I'm just going to use this brief introduction to say, you know what? Thank you for listening. You got us through 100 episodes of, you know, something that I really enjoy doing. And I hope that comes across to you guys every week. So just for the upcoming future, again, I'm heading home. So this is definitely going to be one of my main focuses along with my internship at Cressy Performance. So it's going to be a great opportunity to bring you guys even more awesome content. And we're going to keep trying to have one guest every single week. I'm lining up our guest for next week right now. To find out about who that's going to be, make sure to look at thefitcast.com. We're putting new stuff up there every day, whether it be blogs or articles, things like that. So we'll post who that guest is going to be probably on Monday or Tuesday. So make sure to check that out so you can get in your questions submitted to the show. And you know what? Please feel free to leave comments on the website. You can shoot me comments through the website as well. Just let me know what you think of the show, anything that you want to see, any guests that you want to have. We're going to do our best to fulfill all your requests for what you want to see in the show in the future. And I think that's about it. So you know the drill. Please check us out on iTunes. Please subscribe through iTunes. If you can throw up a review, that would be awesome. You can just do that by simply clicking, you know, leave a review. Every little bit helps. And you know what? You can always spread the word by using Facebook. We're on Facebook. The whole cast is on there. So you can add us as friends. You can subscribe to the FitCast group. And we also have a fan page up there as well. So I'm going to get out of the way. And we're going to have, again, two... Pretty much this is my favorite show that we've ever had. We have John Berardi, who just, you know, brings his A game every single time. Some really cool stuff that he's going to talk about. And then Tom Venuto, who's going to be talking about really his expertise is fat loss. So you're going to get some great fat loss information in there as well. So again, thanks for listening, guys. I really appreciate all your support that you've given us in the past. And we're going to be bringing some good stuff, and hopefully we'll have another 100 episodes in the future. So enjoy it. With us right now is Dr. John Berardi. Our guests know him very well. I think this is his third time on the show. But for the listeners that don't know much about John, he has earned a doctoral degree from the University of Western Ontario with a specialization in the area of exercise biology and nutrient biochemistry. Prior to his doctoral studies, Dr. Berardi studied exercise science at Eastern Michigan University, their master programs in 1999, as well as health science, physiology, and philosophy at Lock Haven University. He is author of Gourmet Nutrition with John, our former co-host John Williams, and also Precision Nutrition. He worked on Scrawny to Brawny, most recently the Metabolism Advantage, and of course, everyone probably checks out the PrecisionNutrition.com forums, and I hope many of our listeners already own a copy of that. But JB, it's great to have you back on the show.
Hey, well, thanks for having me back, and it's very exciting to be back for the 100th episode. So I appreciate you guys having me on, and you know, sharing some knowledge today.
Absolutely, like we did a poll on our website for for the guests that we're going to have for the 100th episode. You got the most votes, so you're definitely you're a fan favorite.
By popular demand.
Exactly.
That's always funny. It's like when a fighter loses a fight, they'll always be like, yeah, I lost tonight, but the fans cheered loudest for me, so yeah, I can take solace in that also. But regardless, it's nice to know that people wanted to hear what I have to say and had some questions for me and stuff like that, and hopefully we can make it a real informative call for them.
Absolutely, and for the listeners out there, we also have Jimmy Smith. Jimmy, are you there?
Yeah, I know what you want me to say, John.
It was kind of quiet for a second there. I was expecting like the applause to start, but it was just quiet.
Well, Jimmy has two or three fans of the on the show, so.
Yeah, two or three, that's all.
Excellent. Well, you know, if you keep working hard, maybe it'll be four or five one day.
Yeah, I'm trying to. You know, it's a long way to go to become the third most popular guest or whatever Kevin's called to. Working my way up.
That's always good. It's good to have something to, you know, like a goal in life, Jimmy. That's always what we strive for. But first off, JB, we know that there's a lot of stuff going on at precisionnutrition.com. Do you want to start off talking about what's new at the website?
Well, a lot is new. A couple things I can talk about, and then there's a couple of hush-hush top secret projects as well that'll be launched in the next month or so. But, you know, for people who've been kind of following along, they know that, you know, we released the Precision Nutrition Volume 2 and also Gourmet Nutrition Volume 2 in the last year. So basically Precision Nutrition, what we did is sort of updated it as if like a university textbook would be updated into like a new version or a new volume with kind of the latest information, you know, and just polished up with each couple of years. That's what we did with Precision Nutrition. And then with Gourmet Nutrition, we launched a brand new recipe book with 120 new recipes, all categorized by post-workout or any time, like our first one. And, I mean, the production values on this thing are huge. It's beautifully photographed. There's color photos of every recipe. The feedback on it so far has been absolutely amazing. So, that you know, both of those are two exciting things. Another thing that's a lot more recent is our lean eating coaching program, which we launched very recently. So what we did was, after years of doing sort of this one-on-one individual coaching, we realized that, you know, there'd simply be no way to take on as many clients as wanted to work with us. So we decided to create kind of like a hybrid solution where we could actually work with 100 people, 100 men and 100 women simultaneously, to sort of coach them on fat loss and, you know, how to eat better and how to exercise properly and how to design their own training programs and all that kind of stuff. So we actually started that off in the summer, and it was fantastic. I mean, we were blown away by the response. Literally, we filled all 100 spots for men and 100 spots for women in about 12 hours.
Wow.
So we just kind of announced it, and boom, it was full. And so we have this fantastic waiting list, which was crazy because the whole point of doing it was to eliminate the previous waiting list that we had. But so we have a new waiting list to work with. But I mean, that's a pretty cool program. And, you know, for those people who didn't get in the first time around, because I'm sure there's a bunch of them listening in, we're planning on launching one soon. And if you jump on the waiting list right now, there's a good chance you'll be able to get in on the next one. I can't say when it is for sure, but it'll probably be the end of this year or at the latest early next year. So that's another exciting thing. And that course, it's a 16-week program. It's going so well, and you know, we're keeping wraps on what everyone's saying about it until the end. But the feedback we're getting is phenomenal. I mean, I get daily emails from dozens of people talking about how much fat they're losing, how much muscle they've gained, how much they love the course, how much they've learned about themselves, how much they've learned about eating. So it's fantastic. You know, the whole premise of it was to go beyond just like, hey, what should I eat, and actually help change people's lives, the way they look at food, the way they look at their fitness, the way they look at themselves. And we're accomplishing that, so I'm super pumped about that. And then the last thing, and then I'll stop plugging stuff here, is our Precision Nutrition Certification, which is coming out early in 2009. So basically what we're doing is we've created a really, really comprehensive certification program that'll take people through basically what we do, both scientifically and practically. And so it's predominantly geared at fitness professionals and strength coaches who want to be able to talk nutrition and, you know what they're talking about with their clients and athletes. So that's coming up early next year. So with that said, I'll wrap up, you know, my precision nutrition portion of the call, and we can get to some other stuff.
Well, JB, man, that's really cool that you're going to have a precision nutrition certification. That's something that's I personally think is drastically needed in this industry right now.
Yeah, well, I've looked around at some of the nutrition certifications currently available. And the one huge gaping hole in what they offer, at least in my opinion, is that they pretty much take you through a very textbook treatment of nutrition. So they have a chapter on digestion, and they have a chapter on protein, and they have a chapter on carbs, and they have a chapter on micronutrients, and then they say, well, vitamin A is similar to beta carotene, and it's found in carrots and these leafy vegetables, and if you don't have enough, you have poor eyesight or whatever. And it's super boring and really irrelevant to the average client. So what we've done is we've sort of created this very comprehensive manual that contains both the scientific aspect of it, but also a really practical applied aspect where it's literally on the first meeting with the client, here's what you have to do. And the second meeting with the client, here's what you do. If your client tells you this, this is the type of dialogue you have to initiate. So there's psychology, there's business, there's all this stuff wrapped in. So it's more than just teaching someone about food. It's about it's teaching them about how to run a business, which includes nutrition in it as a service. Because nowadays the research is coming out, and it's really, really clear that and trainers have known this for years. When you work with a client and they don't change their nutritional habits, it doesn't matter what exercise you throw at them. Rarely do they have like jaw-dropping, eye-opening changes, the type of changes they hired the trainer to accomplish in the first place. And at a recent seminar, I reviewed a couple of these studies, and because we actually just finished one up at the University of Texas, where we actually had people training about 6 hours a week with a trainer. And for about 75% of the sessions, they were with an Olympic weightlifting coach who was overseeing their strength training. And then the rest of the sessions, they were doing group exercise, sort of like circuit-style interval training. And so we trained them like this for 16 weeks. And, these people were sedentary to start with, so they were doing nothing. And at the end of the study, when we compared our control group, which continued to do nothing, and the exercise group, which did 6 hours of well-supervised exercise, the difference between the groups, although there was one, was so embarrassingly small that truly, if I had hired a personal trainer for 16 weeks to work with me and I got those kind of results, and I had to pay the equivalent of whatever it would be, $3,000, $5,000 in training to get to that point, I'd be like going after that person with a machete. The difference between the training group and the non-training group was that the training group lost an extra 1 pound of fat over the course of the 16 weeks. And again, this was no joke. The training was hard, and these people were sedentary. They did nothing. So they went from 0 to 6 hours of training. I designed the strength training programs myself, and for those who think I'm good at what I do, they'll say, oh, that's pretty good. And for those who don't, then this won't mean anything to them. But nevertheless, I designed the programs, and we had great supervision. So the training program wasn't the problem. Their effort wasn't the problem. We only included people in the study analysis who made it to 90% or more of the training sessions. So really what it points to is that because we didn't do a nutritional intervention, that was the point of the study, that if you just train without changing your nutritional plan, you're not going to see very good results. And that's not just one study. I've got like 5 or 6 that I could talk about in depth showing the same exact thing. In fact, there was a study done about a year ago that used almost the same protocol we did that was 10 weeks in length, and the results were eerily similar, meaning that the participants only lost a tiny bit more fat when they actually trained versus not training, and only gained a tiny bit more muscle than when they actually trained versus not training, which really highlights the importance of nutrition in the whole prospect here. And I think, the good trainers have known this for a long time, but a lot of trainers have kind of ignored it and thought, hey, well, if I make this person work hard enough, if I make them do cardio every single day and some intervals and some strength training, maybe we'll overcome their crappy diet. And the answer is it probably won't. And so, you know, with respect to this certification program, what we're trying to do is help supplement fitness professionals' arsenal with a great nutritional program that works and a good system for implementing it, so that they don't fall victim to the same results that we saw in this study, where they have all these clients who are training and going, how come I don't look like I want to look? You promised me I would, and I've paid you a lot of money. And you're saying, well, it's your fault you didn't change your diet. Well, that only goes so far. If you're a good fitness professional, you've got to put something in place so that people can actually succeed. And, you know, you can't just blame it on the client and say, well, you didn't change your diet. Well, you didn't coach them well enough to get them to the point where they could change their diet, or they knew what to do, or you didn't build it into your program. So trainers have to take a little responsibility for their own client's success. And they can't just point the finger back at them and say, well, you sucked, so that's why you continue to suck, you know?
So, JB, how's it going to be set up? Is it going to be, like, tiered, like, a couple different levels? Are they going to have to do
No, pretty much it's just the highest level is what people do. So, so rather than, you know, rather than having, like, level one, level two, level three or whatever, basically when you come to get certified, everyone who gets out of the program is the equivalent of like level three. It's you know, I'll just give people a heads up. It's not going to be easy. It's not just read a book and take a test. There's actually an internship requirement, and there's also a practical component where you have to submit case studies to us. So it's sort of three-tiered. Like, we got to prove that you can learn the material from the book and apply it. We got to prove that that you can actually take a client and get results with them. And then you have to do an internship where you actually learn from our team. And it'll be distance-based, so it's cool. Like, people don't have to move to Canada or Austin or wherever I am at the time. But you know, we're going to make sure that everyone that comes out of this program is really good at this. And so that's sort of our level of quality control. And I don't want to go too far into depth beyond that, simply because we're still sort of sorting out those last minute kind of details, and you know, that'll all be ready to go for 09.
Awesome.
Very exciting stuff. Well, we do have a handful of questions from the audience, so we'll start off with the first one from Matt Tuck. He says, hey guys, first off, congratulations on the 100th episode. That is freaking awesome. Also, I want to say that I'm glad that Kevin is coming back to the fitness profession. Okay, I'm a big believer in the whole G-Flux school of thought and was wondering about metabolism and types of training. My question is, how should I train to get the benefits of an increased metabolism along with the muscle-building benefits?
Yeah, it's a good question from Matt there. You know, and what I mean, whenever someone asks me a question, they always give me clues to what their thought process is. And so the clues I'm getting from Matt here are that he thinks there's an essential kind of tension between training a lot to get your G-flux high and building muscle. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's basically asking the question, like, hey, you know, this whole idea of G-flux, and for those people who aren't familiar with the idea, wrote a couple articles on it. You can pop over to the website and do a search, and you can find the G-flux article. But the idea is that, you know, those people who tend to have the best body composition tend to eat a lot of food, but they also do a lot of training. And, you know, while you might not be an Olympic athlete training 15 hours a week or something like that, most people should be doing more if they really want to look fantastic. Now, you know, there's always those people who are recreational and they just want to be healthy, and that's absolutely cool. But if you're the type of person who's saying, hey, I'm training so that I can see my abs and stuff, you need to be doing more exercise than the standard 3 hour a week type gig. And so with the idea of G-flux, it's, hey, let's see how much exercise we can build in, and then ramp your calories up so that you get a good metabolic boost. So anyway, you know, people can look into that more on the website. But, you know, the question here is, how do I do that while also building muscle? And see, I don't think there's an essential tension between the two. Again, I've got Olympic athletes who are literally training 15 or 20 hours a week who are building muscle. The idea is not that you have to structure your workout in some very specific way so that you can also build muscle and burn a lot of calories. The idea is to do the type of exercise that builds muscle, which is strength and resistance training, interval work, stuff like that, and eat enough food. You have to eat a lot of protein, a lot of calories, good carbohydrates, and good healthy fats. And if you do that, then you'll have no problem building muscle. Like I said, I mean, some of these athletes I'm working with, we've got 15 hours of training, 20 hours of training, and we can, you know, in an off-season type scenario, they may pack on 6, 8, 12, 15 pounds of lean mass. So it's those two things aren't in opposition of each other. The real key is just to do an appropriate amount of strength training, you know, your interval work on top of that so that you're burning additional calories. If you're doing any low-intensity work, make sure it's really low-intensity so you're not actually building an endurance-oriented body. So it might be like, you know, if you go for walks or something like that, they're low-intensity. You know, you're not going for long runs. And then on top of that, you just blow up the calorie intake until you actually see yourself gaining lean mass. And in fact, it's one of the best ways to gain lean mass. Trying to exercise just twice a week while just eating enough above that to try and build muscle is actually much less effective at building muscle than doing a lot more exercise and eating a lot more food, because the more exercise you do, the better your nutrient partitioning. And what we mean there is when you have a high level of G-flux, those calories that you do eat are more likely to go towards building muscle and recovery. Whereas if your G-flux is low, then you don't have that level of partitioning. So you might also be partitioning fuel to fat cells and stuff like that. So it's usually amazing when people do this, because even if they train 2 or 3 days a week and ate an appropriate level of calories for that, all of a sudden they increase their training and their food intake, and they think, well, you know, I'll probably gain weight now, but I'll probably gain a lot of fat. And all of a sudden they get bigger and leaner, and they're completely shocked. They don't understand how it works. And it's because they're making some incorrect assumptions about the way that the body works.
All right, well, JB, here's the next question for you, and this comes from Roger. He asks, much like Dave Tate pre-Berardi, my cholesterol numbers are way out of whack. And he lists some numbers. Blood cholesterol, 300 milligrams deciliter. Blood triglycerides, 99, excuse me. That would be way too big.
Yeah, I was going to say, wow, this is... Yeah, we take this man to an emergency room.
His LDL is 250 and his HDL is 500. And he basically wants to know, do you have any supplemental advice on how to bring these numbers into ideal range? As far as nutrition, I follow the PN guidelines with 90% compliance, but I'm currently on week 2 of the Get Shredded diet.
Okay, so I think this is Roger that's called in, right? The one thing that I don't know here is what Roger's weight is and that sort of a thing, because, you know, people often ask these questions about blood triglycerides and cholesterol. And I'll tell you, the number one correlate with blood cholesterol is how much body fat you have. And, you know, there's people out there who are like, hey man, I'm following a good diet and my cholesterol is still high, so diet doesn't help me that much. But then I look at them and they've only been following a good diet for about a month, and they're 80 pounds overweight. The number one correlate with blood cholesterol levels is how much body fat you're carrying, especially in your central region, so like around your stomach area. So for this individual, the first, you know, the best first step for anyone whose cholesterol is this high, and let's put it into perspective, his cholesterol is 300, less than 200 is considered healthy. So he's, you know, he's 33% or whatever over... or 50% higher than what's the upper range of normal. Blood triglycerides, they actually look good. He's at 99. It should be less than 150, so he's all right in that range. LDL is 250, which is huge. It should be less than 100. So that's where most of his cholesterol is coming from, this really high LDL. And then HDL is 56, which should be greater than 60. So he should have his HDLs higher and his LDLs lower. So anyway, with that said, for someone with this type of profile, the first step is weight loss. Like, if this guy lost 50 pounds, he wouldn't have to take any supplements for cholesterol. He wouldn't have to do, you know, too much with respect to his diet to specifically target cholesterol. A lot of people don't realize this, but when you're overweight, you're going to have high cholesterol for the most part, unless you have some genetic freakery going on. And now, with that said, Roger might be listening in saying, hey, but I'm only 165 pounds. And there is the occasional person who has the opposite genetic freakery, where they have this really weird high blood lipid level while they're still lean. But my guess, just looking from this, is that he has a bunch of fat to lose. So the first step would be to lose some fat. And then all of a sudden, you wouldn't have to do anything beyond that. Now, the other strategy beyond just losing body fat, especially that fat in the midsection, would be cleaning up the diet. You know, if you're following Precision Nutrition at 90% compliance, then I'd say your diet's probably pretty clean. But the one thing a lot of people do miss out on is fiber. So when they're making their food choices, even if they're trying to be Precision Nutrition compliant, they're not eating enough fiber. So usually what I recommend there is the easiest way to get fiber is, like, start tomorrow including a cup of beans in your diet every day. So legumes, it might be kidney beans or black beans or chickpeas or whatever. But one cup a day will boost your fiber intake dramatically, and fiber can have a pretty powerful impact on cholesterol. And then if those two things don't help, or if you want to also take the supplement route right now, there's a couple that actually work quite well. For managing LDL and getting that down, they call it no-flush niacin. So niacin is basically a B vitamin. And but when you take the appropriate dose, you get this kind of tingly flush feeling in your skin. It's really uncomfortable. It feels like your skin on your entire body is really like scratchy and tingly. And so it doesn't feel good. But there's this no-flush niacin, which is called inositol hexanicotinate. So when, for most people who don't have science degrees, you might just want to say no-flush niacin.
I was going to say, can you spell that for us?
Yeah. And you know what? If you just go into Google and type in no-flush niacin, mm-hmm. you'll see the chemical word for it. But if you go in any nutritional supplement store, you'll find it. Because they know what we're talking about, because this is a big seller, because a lot of people nowadays have high cholesterol because they're overweight. Another supplement that's really useful in this situation that's been shown to boost HDL while decreasing LDL is called polycosanol, and it's P-O-L-I-C-O-S-A-N-O-L. And polycosanol is actually really interesting because I've written about it in the past because it actually helps to improve reaction time. So it actually is part of a central nervous system stack that we use with our athletes who are strength and power athletes, because it improves their reaction time. But it also works on the cholesterol system of the body, so it can actually decrease LDL and increase HDL. So for this type of person here that we're talking about, again, step one is lose the fat. Step two is increase the fiber. And then three, if you still need it, you might look at a no-flush niacin and a polycosanol supplement, and then you just use as the label directions say. Now, if someone was in a situation where the cholesterol was high and their blood triglycerides were high too, fish oil, there's nothing better for triglycerides, just in terms of an overall healthy thing. Fish oil taken at, 6 to 10 grams a day gets triglycerides into normal range very, very quickly. So that's something also that's really useful. And then sort of one last little piece of advice. There's actually a great website that talks about this stuff in depth, and it's called loweringcholesterol.net. And it's a fantastic resource. It describes what cholesterol and blood fats are all about, how they work, talks about which supplements and which nutritional interventions can help. And so I think it's a great resource. So anyone who's actually in the same boat as Roger here should go check it out. But, hopefully in the call today I made it really simple. There's basically, a couple of steps that are foolproof. You lose body fat, get your fiber up, and then take niacin and polycosanol. And if you do those things, in 99% of the high cholesterol population, it goes back down to normal.
For the next question, I just want to warn everyone, there's a lot of congratulatory comments. So if it sounds like we're patting ourselves on the back a lot for this question, I apologize. This next question comes from Chris Barrett. He says, "Hey guys, I can't say enough how much you and your guests have improved my understanding on a variety of topics in nutrition and exercise in general. I hope you guys keep the show going. Congrats on number 100. My question for JB is, what are some great foods to gain muscle? I'm trying to complete a, quote, lean bulk. I've cut down my running mileage to 40 miles a week. That's down from 75 to 80 miles per week. And I've begun..." Yeah, it is. "And have begun eating more as well. He's in the 3,000 to 3,500 calorie range. This is, but the whole nutritional aspect is just making it a little harder. Everyone always tells me to just eat a lot of calories, but I don't want to eat unhealthy foods in order to gain weight." He says he's trying to gain about 15 pounds of muscle.
Yes, aren't we all?
Everyone. "I have pretty good nutritional habits, like eating whole wheat, healthy fats, including omega-3s, natural peanut butter, almonds, etc., and about 6 meals a day. Any advice would be greatly appreciated." And he also says, He wants to thank Jimmy and I. And also he wants to thank Mr. Barty. He says, you're my inspiration. You are the reason that I would like to get into the nutrition field. Sorry for so many questions, but Mr. Barty, could you explain the path that you took to where you got to today? I think, JB, I think you talked about that in a previous episode, so I'll make sure to reference that in the show notes.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, link to that for sure, because I think we actually did cover it. Although it feels nice that it feels like a Beaches episode, like I'm the one who needs someone's wings or something here. But it's nice to hear that kind of feedback. Yeah. So, yeah, if you can link people to that, that would be fantastic. And we can get some more questions today.
We'll do.
Yeah. And then as far as the first part, it's actually an interesting question, and I found the most interesting part that he actually left out his discussion of his weight training. So he mentioned, you know, what he's doing for running, which not really sure why, you know, you'd be running 40 miles a week anyway if you're trying to build muscle. You might be a runner. I don't really know, but it's kind of leaves it in the dark a little bit. You know, normally when someone's actually primary goal it is to gain muscle, it's kind of hard to do so when you're putting in 40 to 80 miles a week of running. But, I mean, to get to the point with respect to the food, because that's what people mostly want to hear me talk about, I just have a great analogy or even this is more of a story to give. You know, when I work with elite athletes, they're always pretty shocked when I tell them that once they eat the requisite amount of healthy foods in a day, I don't care what they eat beyond that. And so what I mean by that is this. If someone eats 5 to 6 times a day, if they eat their 30 to 60 grams of protein with each meal, if they eat their 2 servings of fruits and vegetables with each meal, if they get their healthy fats in throughout the day, if they take their recovery nutrition, if they eat the bulk of their carbohydrates after their training session, so basically if they're following the precision nutrition principles, beyond that, I don't really care what they eat. They can eat healthy food whatever they consider healthy, or unhealthy food if they consider it unhealthy. I don't really care. And a great example is one of my bobsledders. He walks around normally at about 250 pounds at like 6'3". And he's just a mountain of a dude, super strong, super fast. And he really loves chocolate milk, okay? He just likes drinking chocolate milk. It's one of his favorite things. So whenever he's in a muscle gain phase, like in the off season, we're trying to build strength and we're trying to build muscle, he usually goes up, you know, 10 or 15 pounds in the off season. What he does is he just eats all of his healthy food meals 5 or 6 times a day, and then he adds a liter of chocolate milk on top of every meal.
Wow.
That's what he likes to do, you know? Now, some people think that's nuts. They're like, oh, milk is unhealthy and all that sugar and stuff like that. Well, let me just say, okay, you can't forget that the guy eats most of his food is healthy stuff. You know what I mean? He's eating according to the precision nutrition principles, all right, which we sort of hold up as a good standard of nutrition. He's getting all his fruits and vegetables. He's getting all of his protein. He's getting all of his healthy carbs. He's getting all of his healthy fats. The thing is, though, once you get to a certain point, you still need more calories to gain muscle. And if he just eats those things that he considers healthy or whatever, he has a harder time gaining muscle because he just can't eat all that food. So what he does is he just adds these liters of chocolate milk and he packs on good weight very, very quickly that way. And it works really well for him, and he's happy because he's getting the stuff that he likes. So my advice to most of my athletes who are training pretty hard and putting in a lot of volume is that exact thing. Don't displace the healthy foods from your diet. Don't eat pizza for lunch instead of a healthy lunch. But if you like pizza, you can add it on top of your 5 to 6 healthy meals each day that have all the things that you need to help your body stay healthy and grow. Once you've provided all the building blocks and all the essential nutrients for the day, everything on top of that is what I call discretionary calories. So you just keep an eye on yourself. You know, if you like some of these other foods, I don't care. Add them in. Now, there's a couple caveats. Like, you're not going to add a bunch of trans fats because we know that's really bad for you. You know what I mean? But on top of that, you know, sugar to a hard training athlete isn't poison. I mean, it's only poison if you don't eat any good stuff and your whole diet's sugar. But if you get all your good stuff and you add the other stuff that you like on top of that, and you're watching your body composition, you should do really, really well. So I think, you know, it's sort of part of the, I don't know if it's like a remnant of like the bodybuilding subculture or what, but people just have this idea in their heads that just there's these, all these off-limit foods that you should never absolutely ever eat in your diet, and that even when you're trying to gain weight, like pizza, off-limits, burgers, off-limits, chocolate milk, off-limits. It's no good. It makes people fat and unhealthy. Well, that's absolutely wrong. It's just a limited way of thinking. You know, the best way of thinking is, you know, how does this food fit in for my goals at the present time and for my body? And if it fits in well, then it's not an evil food. It works just fine. You know what I mean? And I have athletes who do the chocolate milk trick with other things. They might like, you know, cereal boxes, cereal and cereal boxes. So they add cereal to their diet. Other people might like pizza, so they add that to their diet. Other people might like McDonald's, so they go and get a small fry and an Angus burger on top of their normal daily routine. And I say go for it. As long as you're not getting over fat as a result, and your goal is to gain lean muscle, and you're eating all the essential foods that you should in the day, slap the stuff on top. It's no big deal. You're not going to die early because of it. You're not going to have some, you know, mysterious health abnormality that comes as a result of it. When muscle gain is the priority, that's what you
do. Hey, John, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, wait, we just lost you at the end of that question, but I think people definitely got the gist of it. Lost you for like 5 seconds.
Oh, okay. All right. No worries. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, so, I mean, anyway, kind of summarizing the point of that, you know, I think that, you know, this question here that, you know, the when everyone tells this individual just eat a lot of calories, that's the wrong advice. I mean, see, this is either-or thinking. One person says just eat a lot of calories, and then the opposite approach is only eat good calories. But, again, like usually when you talk to a true expert in a field, they're usually somewhere in the middle of the extremes. And here, the middle of these extremes is, no, you don't just eat a lot of calories. That's stupid. You'll probably not get all the essential things that you need in your diet, and you'll probably get fat. But on the other hand, just eating what you and your short list of healthy foods is at today anyway, isn't going to work either. So the idea is to get all the healthy essentials that you need, and then add on it whatever you want on top of that, as long as, you know, you're monitoring your body fat and you're not getting too fat.
JB, the next question comes from Dee Dee in Portland, and they want to know, what research has piqued your interest recently? If your favorite lab was just given a huge grant to research anything you wanted, what would you have them study?
Yeah, it's a pretty cool question. It actually ties in really nice. I'm doing a seminar later this year, I believe it's in late September, like the last weekend in September, with Christian Thibodeau and a host of other experts in Montreal. And the topic of my presentation is actually sort of like, I think it's called Beyond the Cutting Edge, new nutrition and exercise trends for the next 10 years. And so the idea is exactly this, like if there was unlimited funds, where is this field going? And I think there's probably two areas that I'd spend a lot of money on if I had it to spend on this type of research. One would be absolutely genetics and nutrition. I've published a couple articles on this topic, and for people interested in the area, you should definitely check them out. And I'll give an example that I actually used in a recent article. I basically interviewed one of the top genetics guys in Canada. And we're actually working with them to come up with a genetic screen for nutrition. But the whole point behind what he does is he looks at the differences between individuals in their processing of nutrients. Because literally, you know, it's the old saying, I don't know if Hippocrates said it or whatever, like one man's medicine is another man's poison. And the whole premise here is that, you know, even looking at something as, you know, relatively benign as coffee or caffeine, in their studies, it was pretty interesting because when you gave 3 cups of coffee a day to a population of individuals, what ends up happening is there's sort of a split, and a certain percentage of this population actually gets healthier when they drink 3 cups of coffee a day. Their heart disease risk decreases, and a host of other nice things happen for them. However, another percentage of the population actually gets more unhealthy. Their heart disease risk shoots up like tenfold when they drink the same amount of coffee. So they said, well, what the heck is going on here? What are the other factors at work? And they actually found a gene that codes for an enzyme in the liver, and it's the caffeine metabolism enzyme. Okay, it's one of the CYP enzymes in the liver. And so what ends up happening is we either, by our genetics, are given a fast metabolizer gene or a slow metabolizer gene. If we have the slow metabolizer gene, what that means is when we drink a cup of coffee, it actually takes a long time for that caffeine to get metabolized and sent out of the body. So the caffeine sticks around for longer. Now, with the fast metabolizer people, what ends up happening is the caffeine goes through the body very, very quickly, and it's out really quickly. So those with the fast gene actually have the health benefits, and those with the slow gene actually have the health detriment. And the reason why they think that people with the fast gene have the benefit is because coffee is actually rich in antioxidants. So what's happening with these people is they drink coffee, they don't get many other antioxidants in their diet, because in the North American diet, it's not rich in antioxidants. So the richest source for a lot of people is their morning cup of coffee or morning, afternoon and evening cup of coffee. And what happens with them is they flush the caffeine out really quickly, but the antioxidants stay. The antioxidants give them this benefit, and the caffeine is detoxified and sent out of the body. So, I mean, it's a fascinating piece of research, and by no means is it the only piece of research looking at the link between nutrition and chemicals that we get from food and health. And there's all sorts of little paradoxes like this. Now, not only is that fascinating from a research interpretation perspective, because every other day we see in the media some new study saying either coffee or whatever food is really good for us, and then the next day there's one saying it's really bad for us, you know, the big question becomes, hey, what was the population's genetic subtype? Because now, I mean, scary as it may seem, all the research that's been done to date now has to be refiltered through this new filter of knowledge. You know, I mean, if we look at, let's say, creatine or something, and it shows that in some subjects it helps them build muscle and others it doesn't, we need to look for a specific gene that may determine that, just like we found with this caffeine and coffee. So, I mean, this is like next generation stuff, but it's actually happening right now. I mean, labs are doing it. It's just not been made cost affordable. What we're doing is we're working with this researcher at the University of Toronto where you can actually take a cheek swab. So you just, it's like a Q-tip that you rub against your cheek, and it grabs some cells from your cheek. You put it in a little dish and mail it to the research lab, and we can actually do a whole genomic profile based on which, you know what nutritional interventions you would need to take based on your genetics. So that's the first one, genes and nutrition. It's huge, it's exciting, it's really highly interesting, and you know, people who are really into health and fitness, I know, will be all over this because you can get an actual profile for yourself. So how can I keep my heart disease risk down? How can I keep my cancer risk down with the food that I eat? Because again, you know, one man's medicine is another man's poison, and I mean, you know, it's pretty cool stuff, that's for sure. So that's one area. And the other area is basically actually research that we're doing right now through our company. It's the link between personality and body composition progress or body transformation. Hmm. The interesting thing is, you know, nowadays the entire fitness industry, you know, when you look at it from a big global perspective, is intoxicated by physiology. They want to hear the science. And when they say the science, they mean the cells, the hormones, the nutrients, all this kind of stuff. And it's so ingrained in the fitness industry that when I actually say this right now, they want to hear about the hormones and the nutrients. It seems like, well, of course we do. But there's a whole other perspective on body change, which has to do with the brain. It has to do with how the brain and your psychology interacts with your stomach, with your cells. It's pretty fascinating stuff, and it's just hard to study because you can't cut open people's brains and have a look inside, because then you can't get them to do another study with you afterwards. You know what I mean? But what we've done is we're actually working with this company that that is one of the top performance assessment companies in business. Like they've run like 3 million of these assessments in the corporate world, looking at these interpersonal characteristics. There's about 15 different personality domains, and what they can do is, you know, a company looking for a CEO or an administrative assistant or a director of marketing will have this person take this profile, and then they'll actually figure out if this person would be good for the job based on that. Another example is in sport. They actually use this extensively in sport when they're recruiting a draft pick. So let's say, for example, the NFL draft is coming up, and you need a key player for your team. Well, you take the list of available players at that position or whatever you're looking for, and you run them through a psychological assessment, and this assessment tells you where they would fit into the team. You can break the assessments down into things like, how will this person perform relative to their ability level? Because if someone's really super talented, they can either perform at their talent, below their talent, or even above their talent based on their mindset and their psychology. And it's really cool. Another thing is you find out if someone's a leader or a role player. And you can't figure that stuff out in a personal interview, but you can with these assessments. So what we're actually doing is we're running thousands of people through this that are undertaking body transformation. So we can actually look at the key psychological variables that are linked to body change. And simply put, some people are going to have an inherent mental makeup that makes it much easier for them to change their body than others. And that mental makeup influences everything. It influences how you perceive stress, so it becomes a physiological phenomenon. Your psychology becomes physiology. It influences little decisions that you make every single day that you may think you're 90% PN compliant, for example, but you're actually not. You're not following the program, and you don't even know it because of your psychology. And, you know, again, I think nowadays people are so intoxicated with the physiology, with the hormones and the nutrients and all that kind of stuff. And when I talk about psychology, I know there's some people listening in right now that are saying, oh, yeah, that's boring or whatever. And it's simply because we're so intoxicated with hormones and that kind of stuff that we're forgetting how powerful our minds are in this process. So what we're going to have is we're basically going to have a profile for people with respect to body transformation. And it's really cool because then what we can do is we can assess people up front and determine which areas they need to improve to have a successful body transformation. And it'll have nothing to do with their cortisol levels. It'll have everything to do with their mental makeup. Mm-hmm. And so it's really, really cool stuff.
That I'm going to have to congratulate Didi or Dede for, A, the greatest question that we've ever had on the show, and JB for probably... So that was just some of the most interesting, and like you said, JB, that's really cool stuff that you're looking at right now.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's super exciting, and you know, no one really else is looking at it in this way. I don't think there might be some other groups, and if you guys know of someone, I'd love you to pass it along to me so I could potentially, you know, get some cool synergy going with them. But you know, this just seems to me the only frontier that's not tapped into. I mean, in the business world, this stuff is commonplace. Mm-hmm. In the sport world, this stuff is commonplace. But in the fitness world, trainers don't even figure out how their clients think before they start working with them, and it's scary. You know what I mean? You just don't know how to motivate someone if you don't know how they think, and you don't know how to get someone to change their bodies if you don't work on certain areas of their psychology. And again, I mean, if we had another 2 hours, we could go into some of the details of it, but it's pretty wicked when you can break down some of these personality domains. And I'll just give you an anecdote. When I first started working with this company, you know, I had them do a profile on me. And what they did is they sent me back this printout of all the personality domains and where I ranked relative to the population. And then they had like this an essay which describes me, my work style, my motivations, all this kind of stuff. Like they're basically trying to tell me about myself. And when I read it at first, I was like, man, that's pretty cool. You know what I mean? They're pretty accurate. But I missed the whole point because the next day, a representative from their company called me. A guy who I'd never met, never even spoke to in my life, and basically told me all about myself, about my work style, about, you know, how that would affect my personal training, the way that I look at the world. And the guy was bang on, and the assessment only took an hour and a half. So in an hour and a half, this guy figured out what it would take to motivate me, how I would behave in the world, how I'd behave when a challenge would come up in my life, how I might run my business, how I might approach my training, in an hour and a half, and I never met him. And all I had to do was answer some questions. It was really eye-opening at that point. And so we started using these assessments for our staff. So whenever we wanted to hire someone new at Precision Nutrition, we would base it largely on this, and also on the clients that we take on. So anytime a new athlete comes to work with us or a new client, everyone in our Lean Eating Coaching Program gets to take this assessment. And so, I mean, it's really cool from a very personal perspective so people can figure this stuff out for themselves, but even cooler from a research perspective, because I'm a research guy, because now I can run through every assessment in a big database and look at correlations, look at causal factors, and figure out what it takes for the population at large to get in shape.
Very cool stuff, man. We have the next question that's also from Dede. I've recently taken a break from strength training to see how my body does with endurance sports. I'm not sure it's ultimately my thing, but I'm cycling my first century in 4 weeks and running my first marathon in 10 weeks. I'm having trouble during my longer runs and rides, those exceeding 3 or 4 hours, not only eating every 2 hours and ingesting vegetables at each feeding, but also figuring out where the energy gels, glucose powders, and electrolyte drinks fit into the mix. My question is, are all the goos, sugar waters, and salt pills really necessary? Is there a healthier, more whole food approach to staying fueled, hydrated, and chemically balanced during long rides and runs?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, anyone who steps into the endurance world away from the strength training world has like an interesting awakening, because while the strength training community has its own like quirky, weird stuff, the endurance training community has it too. You know, it's not just the sole province of the weightlifters. You know what I mean? In the endurance community, they've got all their weird drinks. They've got all their weird gadgets. Triathletes, cyclists have all these crazy little devices that they put on their bike, or they try and eliminate like 1 ounce here and there from their cycle because it's going to help with their efficiency on the bike. So it's really interesting to non-endurance people that this actually exists, but it absolutely does, and it could be equally confusing as muscle building supplements and stuff like that. I keep it very simple. I mean, my dissertation work, part of it was done on high level triathletes and cyclists. So I know a lot about this community. I've been at the Tour de France with athletes in the past, so I'm real familiar with the endurance world. And what we do is we keep it fairly simple. When we're talking about training rides like this and stuff, what we do is we have a real simple formula. We just use protein and carbohydrate drinks while you're on the bike at a ratio of 2 to 1, so carbs to protein. So what we use is 15 grams of protein and 30 grams of carbs per hour of training. So to put that real simple, you just kind of look at it this way. If you're going to be on the bike for 3 hours, over that course of time, you're going to use like 15 times 3 and 30 times 3. So 45 grams of protein and 90 grams of carbs. You might mix it into 3 drinkers or 3 shaker bottles or whatever, and stick them into all the little nooks and crannies on your bike. And you just sip at that rate, 15 protein and 30 carb per hour. It helps tremendously with recovery, helps with energy provision, and it helps prevent you from going over the top. I see some cyclists like downing these goos and these like Gatorades and all these Powerades and all these energy drinks and stuff like that like crazy, and then they overeat, in addition to their normal diet. They just get too many calories. So I like to use a real simple formula, just 15 protein, 30 carb while you're on the bike, while you're running, whatever the case may be, and then back to normal healthy eating the rest of the day. You don't have to do too much other crazy stuff in addition to that. In addition, what we do is, if we're using this drink, we'll try and get some electrolytes in there. A simple way to do it would be to use Gatorade plus some vanilla whey protein. Most everyone's probably familiar with the fact that I helped develop BioTest Surge, which is another good product for this type of application. So, I mean, you can go the real, you know, inexpensive route and go try and source your electrolytes and your proteins and your carbs and mix them up, or you can get prepackaged or whatever. But I try and keep it pretty simple. Healthy food throughout the day, these types of drinks during your training. It helps certainly with endurance on the ride. It helps with recovery. And it also helps you scale your energy intake, because if you're only training an hour during the day, then you get fewer calories by virtue of these drinks. If you train 4 hours, then you get four times as many calories while you're on the bike. So it scales really nicely with the amount of work that you're doing.
Let's go from healthy food to superfood. Did you like that transition?
Yeah.
I'm working on my radio career. I apologize. The next question is I've been using Greens Plus on and off for the last 3 years due to your recommendation of the product. I would love to know your thoughts on Biotest's similar product called Superfood.
Yeah, I get this one probably like once every 3 days or so, ever since Biotest came out with this new product called Superfood. Most people who, you know precision nutrition, who know me, know that I've worked in conjunction with Biotest in the past. I've been a freelance writer for their testosterone site, and I've also helped develop some of their products. So, you know, that's full disclosure, whatever the case might be. With respect to this product, you know, There, I have two ways of looking at it. One is the ingredient label seems great. You know, I mean, from what's included in it, seems fantastic. The only reason I continue to sort of recommend Greens Plus as my predominant green food or superfood product is because of the wealth of research that's been done on it. Biotest may be doing that research right now, and if they are, you know, when I'm privy to it, I'll include it in my recommendations. But, you know, I am privy to the Greens Plus research. In fact, you know, they've done about 4 different studies looking at that product and the combination of ingredients, showing some really awesome things. And, you know, I also happen to sit in an unpaid position on the research board for the company that makes Greens Plus. So I don't get paid any money, but what I do get to do is I get to interact with some great researchers and also get to help allocate the money that they do spend on research to the right research institutions. So, and sometimes that's, you know, the institutions that I'm involved in. So what ends up happening is I get to not only see the research that's published, but stuff that's in the pipeline. They've got a whole bunch more studies coming down the pipe. So, I mean, with that said, ultimately, when you're me, you have to make a recommendation based on some evidence. And when it comes to Greens Plus, I've seen evidence. I've seen evidence that it's a good product. It does what they say it's going to do. It has high antioxidant potential in the body, has a great ability to balance out an acidic diet, and it also has some real direct, you know, benefits with respect to health and what they call vitality and even bone density and muscle mass, so things like that. So I know that. With Biotest Superfood, I don't really know because I haven't seen the evidence. It looks good on paper. It may turn out to be equally good. So I kind of have to wait for the research to come in on that. So that's kind of my opinion. I know people would probably just prefer me to say it's awesome or it sucks, but you can't know until someone does a research study on it and tells you whether it's awesome or it sucks. You know what I mean?
I was just waiting for you to say, like, I usually stick with Greens Plus because it tastes great. That's what I was looking for, man.
Well, I'm not a liar.
but it's all good. I mean, I used the Berry Greens Plus in the past, and I just happened, I did end up trying out some superfood because I happened to be making a Biotest order. So
yeah. Well, you know, if you're a U.S. Greens Plus user, you know, I'll be completely honest. Biotest Superfood tastes way better, no question about it. That's taste, though. But, like, you know, a Snickers bar tastes way better than a protein bar, you know what I mean? So we can't make our determination based on taste. I, fortunately, spend most of my time in Canada, and it's a completely different company that sells Greens Plus in Canada, and their product actually tastes good up here. And that's not just me. That's actually been independently confirmed by hundreds of others. They have, like, you know, a whole host of flavors. They've got, like, chocolate raspberry, which actually is my favorite. They've got tangerine, mixed berry, blackberry.
God, we need a black market for Greens Plus in the United States.
I know. So we need some, like, Greens Plus mule sneaking, like, swimming through the Great Lakes or something with greens on their back. I don't know. But yeah, unfortunately, in the U.S., it's not the best tasting product that you can get exposed to. And so, yeah, from that perspective, and you probably agree with me, Kev, the BioTest stuff definitely does taste better in the U.S.
Yeah, but I mean, that's, again, like you said, we're not necessarily taking it for its great taste. But
yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, I guess tastes better relative to what, right? Because it's definitely not like a Dairy Queen Blizzard.
Exactly. Well, you can, like, I mean, in the past, like, I just used mixed the berry greens plus with some Crystal Light and, like, my branched-chain amino acids, and, you know, it tastes pretty good, so.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can sneak it in. I mean, if you just try and, like, put 8 ounces of water and the stuff in there, no good. You try and make it into, like, a super shake, and you put, like, frozen berries in and stuff like that. Not bad. And like you said, even with a little bit of Crystal Light to sweeten it up, that helps, too.
Definitely. Well, we're going to wrap it up here. John, before we do go, are there any articles or I know you did mention some, you have a seminar coming up that will definitely, if you shoot me the information on that, I'd love to post it in the show notes if there's any spots available.
Yeah, for sure.
But is there anything that you want the audience to keep an eye out for?
Well, you know, the big things that we're spending a lot of time on working on are the things I talked about earlier. So, you know, definitely, if the audience doesn't have Gourmet Nutrition 2 or PN 2 yet, I really encourage them to get it because, you know, they go into depth on all these things that we talked about today in a real practical and applied way that you can use immediately to turn your nutritional life around, so to speak. And the cool part is you also get access to our Precision Nutrition community, which is about 40,000 people right now.
Wow.
So it's pretty sweet because it's basically 40,000 people around the world all coming together, super supportive of each other, just helping each other reach goals that they're after. So I love it. I mean, it's one of my favorite parts of what we do. And then I also mentioned the Lean Eating Coaching Program. Really, like I said, it's amazing, and I'm the president of the company, so I know some people will be skeptical, but it really is changing a lot of people's lives with respect to their views on exercise and nutrition. And if people are interested in that, they need to go over to the site. And if you come over to precisionnutrition.com forums and just type in lean eating coaching, you'll find out where to do this. But you just sign up for our waiting list if you're interested, and then we can give you more information. And the next time we open up another 200 spots, we can give you a chance to get involved, because we only take in new groups once every 5 or 6 months or so. So if it's a long wait if you don't get on one of the lists. And then again, for the fitness pros in the audience, definitely keep an eye out for our certification, which will be coming out early 2009, because, you know, again, we're biased, but we think it's going to be the best one that that our industry has seen. And, you know, again, it's going to be pretty rigorous to get through, but in the end, you're really going to know what the heck you're talking about. So that, I think that's what people are after when they try and get a certification anyway.
Absolutely. Well, JB, again, thanks. It's always a huge pleasure to get you on the show, and we'll definitely have to keep in touch in the future for this interview. We will have Tom Venuto coming up right after the short commercial music break, so I hope
Awesome. Everyone
enjoys that.
So again, yeah, and thanks. Thanks, guys, for having me. I really appreciate it, and say what's up to Tom for me.
Absolutely. Will do, man. It's always
thanks,
a pleasure.
JB.
With us right now is Tom Venuto. You probably know him from burnthefat.com, but just a little bit more about him. He was a competitive bodybuilder and fitness industry expert since 1989. Actually, you know what? First off, we could wish you a happy birthday, Tom.
Thank you.
So, I mean,
I wasn't sure if I should celebrate or mourn because it was a big one.
The big 4-0, huh?
The big 4-0.
We'll get to that a little bit more in a second. But again, many of our listeners probably know him from his best-selling ebook titled Burn the Fat, Feed the Muscle. And you can check that out at burnthefat.com as well as a lot of other Tom stuff. But he's also been a professional bodybuilder in the past. And I'm really nervous for this interview because I'm a big fan of Tom's, and I read a lot of his stuff online. So just bear with me, but Tom, it's a huge pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's an honor for me, especially since it was your 100th show. I saw that it was your 100th, and I figured it was a special anniversary for you. And I was also checking out on your site. You had a vote for your listeners and your visitors to pick who was going to be on the show, and I saw the John Berardi and a lot of big names, and my name was not on there. So I clicked on there and voted for John. Apologies to everybody else who was on the list. And then you said you were going to invite me, and at first I was like, how did that happen? I wasn't even on the list to get voted to be on the show. I mean, I didn't displace John, did I? The Science Link team's going to have Hitmen out for me. but then you said you were going to interview John, too, so I thought that was great. I'm a big fan of John.
Yeah, what I kind of set up the poll as is I knew in the past we've had requests to have you on the show, and I wanted to give people, you know, a chance to pick one of our guests, but I wanted to have you on no matter what, and in this way it's kind of a surprise to our audience as well. It's like a special treat for them for episode 100, so it works out great for everyone.
That's cool. It's a treat for me too. Thanks again.
Well, let's jump right into the questions. The first one we have comes from Chris. He says, just curious on your thoughts about fructose. Should the average person avoid a lot of fruit? I tend to avoid starchy carbs altogether, instead focusing on lean protein, fruit, and veggies, in addition to healthy fats. Should I be worried about the fructose stuff? I eat 3 to 5 pieces of fruit a day, and that includes apples, grapes, bananas, oranges, and really whatever's on sale at the store.
Yeah, you know, I saw this topic got stirred up again just a few weeks ago. There was a study published in June, and then it got written up in the New York Times about fructose getting converted into fat. And you know how awesome the media is at writing up scientific research, right?
Oh, it's great. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I go to the New York Times for all my information, actually.
Yeah. Well, it was the Journal for the American Nutrition Society, I think, and the title, like right off the bat, was like really damning. It says dietary sugars stimulate fatty acid synthesis. And then the New York Times article says, does fructose make you fatter? And everybody sees that and they're like, oh my God, it's turning into fat. And to tell you the truth, me having started in the bodybuilding world, I believe that too. That's what I was taught. I was taught that fruit turns to fat, and when you go on a contest diet, you have to cut the fruit out. And so when I was just starting out in bodybuilding, my first few contests, I cut the fruit out. And then I started to really analyze it, and it didn't seem to make any sense to me. So I put the fruit back in, and I didn't see one shred of difference. And if you really go and look at these studies, like this new one, they were talking about high fructose corn syrup, not whole fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we know that the fructose goes to preferentially restore the liver glycogen, and the liver's got a limited storage capacity. And some of the studies suggest that about 50 grams of fructose before it starts to spill into fat, at least in the context of those studies. But does anybody know how much 50 grams of fructose is? I mean, in terms of like soda, high fructose corn syrup, I don't think it's hard at all to get 50 grams. And in that study, they didn't give people whole fruit. They gave them this liquid dose. It had 85 grams of carbs of a 75% fructose solution. So that's like 60 something grams of fructose. So there you have it. That's consistent with what you'd expect based on the research. Now, if you look at whole fruit, everybody saw the headline and they think, well, fruit equals fructose. But fruit and fructose aren't exactly the same thing. A lot of people think that all the sugars in fruit is fructose. But a typical piece of fruit has what, about 6 to 7 grams of fructose? Maybe,
yeah, exactly.
maybe you get like 10 in a big banana. And some of the berries that are like really high in fibers, like 2 to 3 grams of fructose. So, I mean, it would take a whole buttload of fruit. Almost an impossible to eat amount, especially if you're trying to stay in a calorie deficit, for that to cause any fat storage. And if you're in a calorie deficit for the day anyway, should we really be worried about it?
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, I think fruit is good for fat loss diets. I mean, you could actually make an argument that you should include it because it's high in fiber, it's high in the water content, and we know that that's a combination right there, high fiber, high water, that's good for reducing appetite and making you feel fuller. And I think I even remember seeing a study once that low liver glycogen increases hunger. So that, you know, increasing hunger that way wouldn't be a good thing. So, you know, maybe the pre-contest bodybuilder or the low-carb dieter is going to pull back on fruit a little bit, but that's mainly a function of cutting down on everything across the board, cutting on carbs across the board and cutting down calories across the board. I mean, fruit is just too nutritionally valuable to get rid of.
Exactly. I think something that Craig Ballantyne actually said was he's never had a client that got fat by eating fruit. They got fat by having, you know, your breads are really going at, like, your pastries, like your junk food, your pizzas, things like that. Like, you're not going to get fat by eating fruit. I think people are just focusing on the wrong things.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. Eat your fruit.
Exactly. I mean, come on, guys. Just have, like, a couple blueberries or a banana. It's not going to kill you. The next question comes from Hunter. He says, hey, guys, quick question for Mr. Venuto. I'm 16 years old, weighing in at 172, coming down from 160. He says he was at 160 after a three-month bulk. So, I'm sorry, he's at 172 after a three-month bulk where he started at 160. And he went from a 12% body fat to 14% body fat during his bulking, mostly losing some definition in the abdominals. That being said, I don't think I would be alone in seeking your opinion and or methods for a clean bulk. He says, I know Jimmy discusses that very well in the physique formula, but an overview would be great. So what suggestions would you have for Hunter?
Well, I think rule number one on a bulk is don't get fat. I mean, there's really no excuse for getting fat. If you want to use the word bulk, I think you got to make sure you're referring to muscle bulk,
mm-hmm.
because so some people's definition is bulk is gaining as much weight as possible and putting on a lot of fat with the muscle. And I mean, that's old school approach that should stay back in history, because it's just too hard to take the fat back off. If you put it on, you're gonna have to take it back off. So
mm-hmm.
if you're in the teens in your body fat and you're starting to creep up, you definitely have to do something to nip that fat gain in the bud. So it start off with the mentality that you're doing a lean, you want to gain lean muscle, lean bulk, and not fat. The longer you have to diet, the harder your diet is going to be. Coming down from 14% body fat, let's say you want to get down to six pack abs, I mean, you're talking about, I mean, definitely single digits, but possibly mid single digits or low single digits if you're talking about bodybuilding. And
mm-hmm.
That's a long haul to go from, like, in one stretch from the mid teens or even upper teens of body fat all the way down to single digits. It's a heck of a lot easier to stay single digits, stay disciplined, or say 10%, 11% and cut down from there, and you're less likely to lose muscle. I mean, see, you might end up losing the muscle that you did gain. If you put on fat and muscle in the process of stripping off the fat, you might end up losing some of the muscle because you have to diet for so long to get the fat off. So I mean, that's number one. I think number two is to make sure you understand your body type. You know, the old ecto, endo, meso,
mm-hmm.
the somatotypes. You know, I know some people say that maybe it's not an accurate way to classify yourself, and it definitely is crude. But in this context, I think it's really, really helpful. You need to know: are you endomorph, which is the big frame person who tends to put fat on easily? Whether that's a genetic trait or it's just a person's metabolic trait, some people end up putting fat on more easily than others. And then you have the ecto, who's the really skinny guy. I mean, that person's not going to have to worry about gaining fat. That person, their biggest problem, the ecto's biggest problem, is going to be eating like a horse and getting enough calories in.
Mm-hmm.
So understand the body types and understand which one you are, and be realistic about it, you know, to be able to look in the mirror and say, okay, I'm an endo. I need to approach it from that point of view. And if that's the case, if you find yourself gaining fat easily along with the muscle, my favorite way to go about a clean bulk is a non-linear approach, or cyclical dieting, or there's all kinds of names for it these days that we used to call it zigzag back in the day. And I like that approach both for fat loss when you're on the deficit side and for muscle gain when you're on the surplus side, because I think for the person who tends to put on fat really easily, if you stay in a linear surplus, you just jack your calories up into a surplus and stay there, I mean, it's virtually inevitable that you're going to gain some fat. And the person with that tendency to put the fat on easily is really going to have a problem. So I prefer to go up and down. If I was cutting fat, I would probably be dropping down to a 20 to 30% deficit, and then I'd be refeeding back up at least to maintenance or maybe even in a slight surplus. So I just approach it the opposite way. For a clean bulk, I would take a few days at maintenance or just in a tiny deficit, and then I would crank my calories up into an aggressive surplus, like 20%. Or if I didn't do – usually I like going in three-day cycles, three days low and 3 days high. Or another approach I might take of a nonlinear dieting is just to crank up my carbs and my calories on training days and make those my high days, and then make the non-training days less food. But either way, it's alternating instead of staying in a surplus all the time.
No, it's interesting that we just talked about that, because our next question is about the anabolic diet and very low-carb diet. So basically this question comes from Philip. He says, hey, Tom, what is your take on the anabolic diet or very low-carb diet under 50 grams of carbs per day? So what do you really recommend to your clients in terms of, you know, because this seems to be a really hot topic. We've talked about it on the show in the past about the anabolic diet, where people just want – they don't want to just see that 1 or 2 pounds per week come off. They want to see 3 or 4.
Well, I'm familiar with the anabolic diet. I'm not familiar with the exact parameters, so I can't really speak to that particular low-carb plan.
Mm-hmm.
But I can definitely talk on very low-carb diets, like around 50 grams a day or so. First of all, I don't think there's any question that it can be an effective approach. For me, it's not so much a question of should you reduce carbs as it is what kind of low-carb diet should you go on, or how much should you cut them. I don't think that the very, very high-carb, low-fat approach is your best means of improving body composition. For me and results I've seen in most of my clients is to start with something that's more balanced. And balanced to me is more like 50% carbs, or in somebody who's a little carb intolerant, maybe even 40% carbs. And from there, what I like to do is just monitor results and pull the carbs down to the point where you start to see the changes in your body comp that you want. Usually, if I were to put a number on it, I personally do best on about 1 gram of carbs per pound of lean body mass, or a little bit less, like about 0.8. And that's in the context of somebody like me who's bodybuilding, doing cardio and training, because I need that many carbs to support my training. So I'll take those low carb days, and then, as I said before, I use a zigzag or a nonlinear approach, and then I'll refeed the carbs either on a cyclical basis, like every fourth day after the glycogen has started to get a little depleted, and or in conjunction with my training. So the placement of your carbs around your activity, I think, makes a heck of a lot more sense than trying to cut them all out. If you're looking at a non-bodybuilding approach, like just say mainstream weight loss, I think even though there's a lot of people who've had success with the very, very low-carb diets, I think you got to look big picture. And anytime you go to an extreme on anything, and I consider 50 grams of carbs a day pretty extreme,
mm-hmm.
you're going to see lower compliance rates, and you're going to see lower long-term success rates. And there's been a couple studies that just came out in the last 2 years that compared the major dietary approaches, your high carbs, low fat versus a balanced, which is like a zone type of thing, or Mediterranean, and an Atkins type of diet. And the ones that were the most extreme on either end had less compliance and worse long-term success rates, and the ones that were more balanced had a better long-term success rate. So that's another question you have to ask. If you're competing in bodybuilding, and if you have a really extreme goal, sometimes it takes a little more extreme of an approach, and maybe you'll pull back the carbs a little bit more. For the average person, I think you're better off with a more balanced approach. But overall, I'm not condemning low-carb diets, because I think you definitely have some advantages there. It helps control insulin. You get automatic calorie control. If you're pulling back on a major food group, if you're starting to pull back on your starches and your grains, it's pretty hard to overeat. and you get some pretty good appetite control. So my approach is I do myself use and I prescribe to others variations on a low carb diet, but not the extreme ones.
The next question comes from Stacy, and I think it's one of the best questions that we've had, and I'm very interested to what you have to say about it. She asks, where do you see the evolution of fat loss programs going in the future?
Yeah, that is a good question. That's a great question. Well, I mean, I think we've evolved light years already, don't you?
Last 10 years, 12 years,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, hey, well, we already revealed my age, so it was just my 40th birthday. So I can go ahead and say that I started around 1989, 1990. I mean, it has completely changed, like 180 degrees. I mean, I think we've made a tremendous amount of progress already, both in the nutrition side and, of course, in fat loss programming for training has completely changed. You know, we're not giving bodybuilding programming to people with strictly fat loss goals anymore. We're taking a different approach and making the training a little bit more metabolic. With nutrition, I think we're not going to see any kind of major breakthrough in the research or some kind of great discovery that's going to completely change everything that we already know, and I don't think we're going to evolve in that sense. There's been so much good information out there now, and there's so many people that really get it already. I don't think we're going to see something evolution in the sense of something just brand new, like the next big thing comes along. I mean, if anything, our attitudes towards nutrition is going to change, like I was talking about before with the low carb diets. I mean, instead of there being these diet wars, like you're wrong and I'm right and my way works and yours doesn't, I think what we're going to see in terms of evolution is the pendulum is going to swing to the center a little bit, and we're going to realize that what all the approaches have in common, and we're going to focus on that. Everybody needs certain essentials. Everybody needs, you know, essential aminos. I mean, the protein's got to be in place on every diet. We know that for a fact now. The essential fatty acids, you got to get the EFAs in. The essential vitamins and minerals, we got to get them in. We're going to get them from our vegetables and fruits. So I think we're going to start to see a lot of agreement on those points, and the evolution will be in the understanding of, okay, from there, how do we customize and individualize without all these dogmatic beliefs and these different camps, you know, bickering back and forth and arguing with each other. So, I mean, at least that's what I would like to see. I'd like to see the whole industry evolve towards how do you, once you have those basics in place, how do you customize and how do you individualize? And that would be a huge breakthrough. And I know some people have already made some attempts to do that, which is a step in the right direction. But I don't think there's any one single program that's perfect for everybody. I mean, evolution is going to be, in nutrition, is going to be recognizing that people are different based on their genetics and based on their metabolism and based on their goals, and we have to be able to prescribe for each individual. And then as far as training goes, I think we've seen the evolution take place there already. You know, I speak from experience when I say that when I was just getting started in the industry, everything was bodybuilding training. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did, and it was right for me as a bodybuilder. And now we've seen that completely shift more towards movement pattern based training and metabolic training, and the same thing is with nutrition. Instead of everybody saying you're right or you're wrong and I'm right and it's my way or the highway, we're going to start to evolve in seeing that there are so many different ways to train. The evolution is going to be in the ability to pick the right one for you, or as a coach to be able to prescribe the right one for somebody. Training is going to be, the science of training will be the prescribing the right program for the right person or choosing the right program. And in some cases, it's a matter of style. I mean, and personality. It's like choosing clothes. I mean, which one do you pick? I mean, what's your style?
Mm-hmm. Well, it should be interesting nonetheless. I mean, like you said, it really does seem like there's been an evolution the last 5 or 10 years, and it'll be interesting to see where we go. Like just before this, we did an interview with John Berardi, and he was talking about focusing on your client's genetics And also, something you also talked about was just their mindset and their profile towards their psychological, like he was talking about doing psychological evaluations and stuff, is really, really interesting. But of course, our listeners just heard that, so just repeating myself, so I apologize. Next question, another great question, comes from Richard. He says, first off, I want to say that I'm a big fan of Tom's Burn the Fat, Feed the Muscle program. This question is for Tom and the gang. What are your feelings on fat loss supplements? Which works best? And he says, for example, thermogenics, topical creams, etc. He also included CLA. I know that I won't get great results from them, but I want to know if I can just get that extra 10% of my fat loss.
Oh man, you want the nice, politically correct, scientifically accurate answer first, or you want to know what I really think?
Come on, open up a can of whoop ass.
Well, personally, I think that fat burners are mostly a waste of money.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the claims in the advertisements far exceed what the studies actually say that they can do. And I think that 90% of the products that are out there don't do anything to begin with. So I think we have to put this in perspective as to what we're talking about. Even with the products that have some data supporting them, we're talking about very modest effects. In fact, you mentioned CLA. You know, for a long time, the data was really, really mixed on CLA. And initially, it was all like rodents. It was like mouse studies. And the funny thing is the sales of CLA that happened back in the 90s were based mostly on mouse studies. But they've kept researching different isomers and whatnot, and they've been doing better study designs. And some recent data is starting to suggest that there may be something there with CLA. But if you go and look at the papers, it's not really impressive. I mean, it's not the type of thing that makes or breaks you at all. It's not even the type of thing that really adds all that much. I would go as far as to say it's minutia. Like one of the studies, fairly recent in 2005, if you read through the whole paper, instead of just reading the conclusion that says, we conclude that COA helps with reducing body fat mass, if you go and read the paper, you'll see, I want to know how much. At 6 months, there was 1 kilo. So do I want to spend my money on a 6 month supply of CLA for 1 kilo weight loss? I don't know. Some people argue that everything counts, and I'm not going to argue with that. But to me, that's minutia, especially if you don't have all the big pieces in place first.
Mm-hmm.
They just did a meta analysis last year in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. They looked at 18 studies, and modest is the exact word that they used. They said 3.2 grams of CLA produces a modest loss of body fat, and the number they gave per week, difference over placebo, 0.09 kilos per week, 0.2 pounds.
Wow.
So is there something there the data says there is, but it's not much. The other thing I saw just recently that was pretty interesting, green tea was looking really good. It definitely looks good for health, no doubt about that. We had those studies by Abdul Dalou at the University of Geneva,
mm-hmm.
and he did the studies on green tea extract. And what his first study, they did used 270 milligrams of EGCG, and they got approximately about 75 calories increase in metabolism in 24 hours. And that's not much, but again, it's something. If you multiply that out, that's about an extra 1 pound of fat every 42 days, right?
Mm-hmm.
That research was replicated a couple of times, and one very recently, they tested, 270 milligrams and then 300 milligrams. Again, they got the same results. So it appeared that would be a mild thermogenic on top of having some health benefits. But here's the question. If you get an increase in your metabolism over 24 hours, is that the same thing as an improvement in body composition over 12 weeks? I mean, it in theory, if the elevation of metabolism continued for week after week and month after month, that would translate into an improvement in body composition. But a University of Taiwan did a study this year, I think it was just a few months ago, and they did a randomized double-blind clinical trial. They used the exact amount of green tea extract in the form of EGCG that was in the previous studies. And this time they ran it over 12 weeks, and there was no weight loss in a group of 100 women. So that was kind of disappointing. And I don't know what the future research is going to say, because it is thermogenic in the short term. But the question is, if you look at these studies on short-term thermogenesis, what does that translate into in body composition over time? I mean, that's an interesting question, because their studies, just like the green tea studies, the studies on caffeine, that they say the same thing. You get a temporary increase in calorie burn, thermogenesis over 24 hours. But I don't know anybody who drinks, you know, coffee every single day, months on end, who lost weight as a result of drinking coffee. You know, and so with thermogenics, since they pulled the ephedrine off the market, I don't think anything has really replaced it. I think what is out there, it's small. If it works, it's small effects. And my advice to everybody is take the claims in the advertisements with a grain of salt. And if you use them, consider it to be the really minor details, you know, the icing on the cake. It's not the thing that's going to make or break your fat loss. I stopped taking ephedrine. I took ephedrine in the 90s and competed many times using it. And then I stopped using it just because I felt like I was abusing it as a stimulant. And the next time I competed, I was in the best shape of my life, and I saw absolutely no difference whatsoever from when I was taking it. You know, I think ephedrine and the stimulant-based thermogenics, especially ephedrine, I think it was proven as a fat burner. There's no question about that. But it was a drug, for one thing, and I think it was overrated as a fat burner and underrated as a stimulant. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the problem came from. People were abusing it as a stimulant. So they started taking it to lose weight. Next thing you know, the students are taking it to stay up at night and to get a buzz, and they're out raving and partying, and they're taking it to stay up all night, and the truck drivers are taking it. Next thing you know, they're addicted to it, and they got to take it to wake up in the morning. And you know, I don't know about you. I mean, I've heard that story hundreds of times. So, I mean, should they have pulled it off the market? I don't know, but I think it was abused as a stimulant. So I'm not a huge fan of fat burners. I'm a fan of, if you look at the amount of weight loss that could be achieved from these things, break it down into how else could you do that? 15 more minutes of exercise a day, maybe? Wouldn't that do the same thing?
Well, if you think about it, it's like 40, on average, probably about like $40 for a month's supply of whatever you're going to go after, and you could save that to, you know, take your boyfriend or girlfriend out to the movie or something like that, and, you know, maybe that money could be going somewhere else, especially like in these, we had a recent discussion on the show a couple of weeks ago. The economy is suffering a little bit right now. You got to make some cuts someplace, and is it going to be on the grocery bill, or is it going to be on your supplements? So,
yeah, good point.
The next question comes from Lisa. Bear with me, it's kind of a long question. She says, my question is in regards to whether a person is eating too much or too little. I recently had my resting metabolic rate tested at my gym, and it is 1,384. According to their calculations and based on my current workouts, I burn on average of 2,400 to 2,800 calories with lifting and cardio. I should eat 1,700 calories to lose body fat and weight. I'm 5'2", and my weight at the beginning of the summer was 109, and I'm gaining a little weight. I am 115 today. I know on most days I am not hitting 1,700, but I have a few times. And again, she says I'm gaining weight. I haven't weighed this much in years. I know it's my healthy weight range, but I want to lose body fat and maintain my muscle. The reason why I'm confused is because I used to eat 1,200 to 1,400 calories and lost 1 or 2 pounds per week. That does not work for me anymore. I am thinking this is because my workouts have changed since then, about 2 to 3 years ago, and I am at a loss. I will have my body fat retested at my gym within the week if the same person is available. And again, that's from Lisa. And this sounds like kind of a common problem.
Yeah, I've heard this or a similar question in many different incarnations, ranging from eating 1,200 calories a day and I'm not losing weight to, you know, I'm eating X calories and I'm gaining weight, but it's below my maintenance, et cetera. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's if I'm hearing her question right, there's some kind of anomaly in the amount of calories she's taken in versus the results she's seeing in her the scale and the in body composition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there could be more than one explanation for this, but I always like to call on that old principle called Occam's Razor.
Yes.
Which says that the simplest explanation is almost always the correct one. And the simplest explanation, if somebody's gaining weight, is that they are in a calorie surplus. And the simplest explanation if someone is not losing weight is they're in energy balance. And if they are losing weight, they're in a calorie deficit. In fact, that is always the case in this situation. Now, there are things that can affect the energy balance equation and make energy balance is dynamic. So the amount of calories a person should require to maintain their weight on paper might not be the case in the real world, and that can throw somebody off. But if somebody wants an explanation for if they're not losing weight, they're not in a caloric deficit. So the solution is to reestablish the caloric deficit. And the only exception to that I would make is if somebody has been really, really severely, chronically dieting. What does tend to happen is metabolism does slow down a little bit. There's an adaptive thermogenesis that takes place. And some people will call this the starvation mode. I've called it that myself in the past. And there is a little bit of confusion about this because a myth about the starvation response is that if you drop your calories down really, really low, metabolism is going to slow down so much that the calorie level you're eating at is going to become your new maintenance level. And that won't happen. That doesn't happen. What does happen is metabolic rate decreases, so your weight loss is less than predicted. So that could be a part of an explanation. Now, if you combine that with the fact that almost everybody underestimates how much food they eat, those two things together can explain why what appears like you should be losing weight because you think you're eating less, you're not losing weight.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody, for one of the first things I'm going to have somebody do in that situation is I'm going to ask them if they're weighing and measuring all their food, if they're really, really doing it by the numbers and know exactly how many they're taking in. So if somebody says, well, I used to eat 1,200 to 1,400 calories and I was losing 1 to 2 pounds a week and that's not happening for me anymore, I'm not necessarily thinking that their metabolism slowed down. I'm thinking that they're probably eating more than they think they are.
Mm-hmm.
So the very first thing we're going to have them do is they're going to start weighing and measuring all of their food. Doing a menu on paper, crunching the numbers, forget about portion sizes, forget about eyeballing it. If you are successfully losing body fat from eyeballing your portions, that's great. I'm not going to say, hey, you're doing it wrong because you're getting the results you want. But if somebody's stuck or they've got some anomaly they can't explain, I want them to know what they're really taking in. So we're going to count everything. And then if the numbers really don't jive, then what we might do is we might start them on, going back to what we talked about before, is using a cyclical approach where instead of keeping them on the low calories all the time, we're going to start using refeeds. So we're going to have them in a deficit for a few days, and then we're going to refeed. We're going to spike the calories and spike the carbs, and that will tend to re-stimulate those fat-burning hormones in the thyroid and bring the leptin back up to normal, and that can help kickstart things and get them back to normal. But you really got to know what you're doing and what you're taking in, because misreporting on food intake, I think most people are totally, totally missing the boat on this and underestimating what they're taking in. It's just amazing how much more you can be eating than you really think you are.
This reminds me of a client that I had up at college, and she actually, it was a female athlete, and she was trying to lose weight, and we had her tracking her daily calorie intake and keeping a food diary, and we started looking at it, and she wasn't losing weight, but she was in the calorie range that she was in a deficit, so she should have been losing weight. And then we kind of sat down before one of our training sessions, and I just said, there must be something wrong. Like, are you sure you're writing down everything? Are you sure you're not, you know, having a handful of potato chips and with your lunch and just not writing it down because it's not a whole bag of potato chips, something like that? And it turns out she was having her roommate had a bowl of Hershey's Kisses, and she would have like five or six of those throughout the day, and she wouldn't count them just because, you know, it's just like, I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot of calories, but it's still going to give you, I think it was like an extra 200 calories or something that she was having a day. And even just that little bit was keeping her from the results. Again, it's not a lot, and it was probably just a small piece of the puzzle, but I mean, stuff like that seems to pop up all the time.
Yeah, I got to tell you something that I told Jimmy Smith about when we were talking on the phone a few months back. I catch everybody with underreporting their food intake. I'm not going to say any names, but there was a guy who's a huge fan of fish oil and taking pretty large doses of it. And somehow we got on the topic talking about underreporting a food intake. And I said to him, I said, I bet you underreport at least 200-300 a day. He says, no way. He's like, I know exactly what I'm taking in. And I said, well, you know that fish oil you take in? Are those invisible calories? Did you remember to count those? Because, well, I mean, how many calories is that? It's fat, right? I mean,
yeah.
just because it's healthy fat, does the calories not count?
So was he taking in like 20 or 30 grams and not counting that every day?
Yeah, he completely, wow. I mean, that was, what was that? Like, it was a couple hundred calories a day.
Yeah, that'll do it. The next question comes from Ernesto Lopez. He asked, my question is for Tom's interview tomorrow, which is today. I probably should have taken that out. But he says, Tom, do you plan on releasing BFFM with different languages, say Spanish? There are many people that could benefit from the program that do not have the ability to read English. He says, thanks a lot in advance.
Yes, absolutely, positively. But I have an excuse for why I haven't done that yet. My book was originally written in 2003, so although this is the good thing about the classics, they never go bad. But but I do have to update some things. I mean, if you think about a 2003, a copyright date. I mean, there's been a lot of research since then, and even things like, you know, ephedrine's gone in 2004. So there's a few minor things I need to update, mm-hmm. and I want to update it before I do a translation. And that has been delayed because I've been working on a new book that's going to come out in hardcover in January. So I got my hands full with that. So when I finish this new project, I'm going to be doing Burn the Fat. We're going to call it Burn the Fat 2.0.
Nice.
And as soon as that's done, we're going to get that translated into Spanish.
Very cool. We're going to have you on again in January. You know that, right? That's kind of a requirement.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I'm game.
The very last question comes from Rick Bertuzzi from Calgary, Alberta. He asked, do you have any equipment at home? And if so, what do you have? What would you recommend as, quote, must-haves for the home? I currently have a treadmill and an Olympic weight weight set, a barbell, and 300 pounds of plates. And he says I also do body weight training. I was thinking of getting a squat rack and adjustable bench. And he says, P.S., it's negative 40 Celsius here during the long winters. I apologize. I think it's bad in Massachusetts during the winter, and I guess that's a little worse. So basically, Tom, I guess the question is, like, what do you recommend for your clients for home equipment for those people that just, you know, have families, they don't have time to make it to the gym?
Yeah, it's funny you ask that because I just wrote the chapter in my new book about training. And I picked out a totally different target audience for this new book as for Burn the Fat. And Burn the Fat, the whole premise is, the subtitle is Fat Burning Secrets of Bodybuilders and Fitness Models. And I speak from experience when I say that the majority of bodybuilders, not all, like to train in gyms. And I'm a gym rat myself, so I've never had a home gym. But when I tackled this new project, it was a different target audience. My goal was to reach millions of overweight men and women, many of which who would not want to join a gym and they wanted to train at home. And I think it's important so that we don't discourage anybody, to let everybody know that you could train at home or in a gym. I mean, whichever. I mean, it may be a really important decision because some people don't feel comfortable in a gym. But it's easy to train at home with really, really basic equipment. If you have two things, you can get a great workout.
Mm-hmm.
A set of dumbbells and your body. I mean, you can do with those two pieces of equipment, you'll never run out of exercises. Now, the next thing I'd get is a barbell set, a bench that's fully adjustable, a squat rack. One thing I don't think he mentioned in his question, a chin-up bar.
Definitely.
Pull-ups are just phenomenal, phenomenal exercise. A lot of people ask me what my what I would choose as my favorite back exercise, and they expect me to say rows, but I almost always pick pull-ups. And it's a good arm exercise, too. It's great for biceps, and there's got to be dozens of variations on pull-ups, too. So a pull-up bar, and then if you're going to go nuts after that, then you'd get a cable apparatus, preferably with a high and low pulley, because now with that little setup, you're golden. I mean, you'll never run out of exercises to do.
Very good, Tom. Well, lastly, I just want to ask you, where can people get some more information on your products and just, you know, like what's your blog and things like that? I know I have your blog bookmarked, but everyone else probably doesn't.
Why not?
I don't know. The thing is, I set up, I have, thanks to Firefox, I have this nice little drop-down bar with, you know, 15 blogs that I have to check out every morning. I'll post it in the show notes. I'll make it a requirement of the show to have that bookmarked, like everyone
all
should.
Right. Well, the hub these days is the blog, Burn the Fat Central, is burnthefatblog.com. Because basically I post there at least once a week and twice a week, including like news and what's going on. The site where people can get my ebook is burnthefat.com. And we have our fat loss community, which is burnthefatinnercircle.com. And that's really grown by leaps and bounds in the last 2 years. So that's the Burn the Fat collection of websites.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Can you talk a little bit about the community just for the audience that might not know that much about it?
Yeah, there's a couple purposes. I mean, it is an education center where we have questions answered in a Q&A column. We have articles. We are just starting to put up videos, exercise videos and tutorial videos. We do a lot of interviews and audios, which can get downloaded in MP3. So in that respect, basically all the information you'll ever need we cover all aspects of fitness and even a little bit of weight bodybuilding, but it's really focused on fat loss. It's a fat loss, weight loss website. And really the highlight of our community is the forums and the support. You know, basically we promote ourselves as a support community, and there's a forum, and it's a very, very different feel than a lot of the public forums, because our whole focus is on support, and I think it's really one of the missing elements in a lot of people's programs. They're going at this alone. They may not have a training partner. They may not have a trainer, and they just need to get somebody in their corner, and they can find that at our Inner Circle site, because I'm in there every day answering questions. We have an expert staff answering questions, and then there's other people, other members in there, getting support to each other and finding accountability partners. And it's really a unique feel. I mean, I don't think there's anything in terms of forums. I don't think there's anything that's public forum that has that kind of that feeling of real positive motivation and positive support. And that's what we're all about.
Very good. Everyone should check all those sites out. I'll have links for all those in the show notes, so you can just head there, and we'll have it all nice and neat there. And again, you have to bookmark Tom's blog. It's great stuff. And really, you're posting on there every day, so there's always something new, or almost every day. So, Tom, just thank you for coming on, and I can't wait to have you on again in the future.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure.
All right, we'll be right back with the rest of the crew. We're going to talk a little bit to wrap up episode 100, and that will do it for us here. So that's going to do it, guys. Again, really, I want to thank you for listening to 100 episodes of us talk about fitness and nutrition. And again, we hope to have 100 more. Don't forget to check out thefitcast.com. Check us out on iTunes. You know, you can also check out our sponsors at Blackstar Labs, TurbulenceTraining.com, RobertsonTrainingSystems.com. They've helped support us a lot in the last 2 years, so make sure to check them out as well. So again, take care, guys, and have a great week at the gym.